This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. There's been more talk in recent weeks about a slowing economy, both nationally and globally. Tip O'Neill famously observed that all politics are local, and to a certain extent, so are economics. So what could a slowing economy mean for Hawaii? That's a question that's occupied the Hawaii Budget and Policy Center. The center describes itself as a nonpartisan organization focusing solely on evaluating public policies and their impact on low- and middle-income Hawaii residents. The group says its mission is to ensure that our state and local economic policies increase opportunity for all residents. Beth Giesting is the director of the Hawaii Budget and Policy Center. And we started a conversation about the local economic future with a look at the past and how national economic issues can play out a bit differently here in Hawaii.
The 2007-9 recession generally was more about the housing bubble, but here in Hawaii, it was more about the impact of everybody else in the United States and the world feeling the impact or being fearful about the impact of a recession. And obviously, one of the first things that you cut when you're fearful about your economic situation is your vacation plans to go to Hawaii. So that certainly has a major effect across our entire economy. First, cutting back on people who work in leisure and hospitality, but then the outward concentric circles of everybody else, retail, durable goods, construction. Construction was one of the big job losers during that period. And our concern, of course, is that the people who lose their jobs first are the people who are low to median wage folks. But the other thing that we're concerned about is that state government is really the only place that we can look to for safety net services, for health and human services, for people more of whom are suffering during that period. And when the state budget obviously is going to be affected by this, because when you have unemployment, you have bankruptcies, you have all of these effects across the economy, the revenues for the state decline. There's less to spend.
And that's the initial point. Declining tax revenue coming in has an immediate impact in terms of what the state is able to do.
Absolutely. One of the things that I had not appreciated earlier is, you know, the recession officially started December 2007. It ended in June 2009. But there's a lag time for how the state experiences mm-hmm. the recession. So really, state tax revenues didn't start going down until about 2009. And didn't really pick up until 2012. So there is a considerable lag time. And in fact, the recession had already started and was well underway before we actually understood that we were in a recession.
And that tends to be the nature of recessions. And economically, nationally, people talk about a recession. And again, the textbook definition of a recession is two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth or of a shrinking economy. But even a slowing economy takes a big bite, mm-hmm. and especially here in Hawaii, a big bite out of the vulnerable.
Yes, absolutely. And Hawaii, I think, is more vulnerable, too, because we are so dependent on tourism, which is a factor of people having excess money that they can spend on an expensive trip to Hawaii.
Memories tend to be short in general,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of policy shocks, is government better prepared now in terms of facing a sharp slowdown potentially?
I'm not aware of it if they are, and that's one of the things that we really want to draw attention to, that our policy leaders ought to be getting together and thinking about this before we're hit with the next one, because there are certain services that should be identified as essential and not cut at all. But also, I think that there are good ways to preserve jobs and income and that will keep the recession from spiraling into a worse state. So Furlough Fridays, for example, was not such a bad strategy, but it could have been done in a much smarter way so that there would be less effect on the workers themselves, on the public, and especially on school kids, who our public school kids lost essentially a full month of instructional time because of Furlough Fridays.
So at this point, what is a better way to look at potential solutions, or as you say, preparations?
Well, I think one way is, first, as I said, let's identify some services that we will not cut because they are the most essential thing to keep people from really suffering the effects of a recession. But there are other ways that we can cut workers' time. This, you know, state costs are essentially are most related to the payroll and those costs. And so we can cut time, I think, from public workers, but we can do it in such a way that it is not as painful to the workers. For instance, they might get a 25% cut in their hours, but they would be able to apply for unemployment to subsidize that so that they're not losing the income fully for that time. There also is the possibility that we would not have to have everybody gone the same day of every month. So Furlough Fridays, two Fridays a month, everybody was gone. All of the state offices were closed.
More of a rotational program to spread that out.
Yeah.
And again, what you're getting at is that idea of planning, thinking ahead about this. And again, at the Hawaii Budget and Policy Center, you do some work looking at, as you said, the state budget more in depth and potential impact on, I keep coming back to the word, the vulnerable.
Yes. Yes. So, yes, our whole intent is to take a look at how our state invests in good opportunities so that everybody has equal chances to make a good living, to do the things that are good for them. And state policy has a lot to do with that. How do we make investments through the budget? How do we tax people? A whole lot of other policies. So this is really important beyond what I think a lot of people realize every day.
And impactful in terms of people's lives, not just numbers in the headlines.
Absolutely. It is really about people who live here.
When you looked in more detail at the impact of the recession 2007 to 2009 in Hawaii, drop of 14% in visitor arrivals and drop in 22% in spending. And you make the point that if a similar thing would happen today on that scale, that would be a $3.7 billion drop in visitor spending.
In the economy. And that is a pretty big impact for a state as small as ours. And so the ripple effects would ensure that there would be a lot less spending overall, that jobs across all sectors, not just the visitor industry, would be affected.
And again, not to paint doomsday scenarios, because that was a severe historic recession. But in your studies, you found that inequity in income and asset accumulation in Hawaii is very sharp and is growing.
Yes, it is very sharp. And it has been on a continuum since the 1980s. The wage effects for low to median income folks was definitely affected more during the recession. And afterwards, people with higher incomes have recovered very much better than people at the lower end of the scale. So there has not been much of a recovery for anybody but people who are earning the most.
So when it would come to advice for policymakers at this point, with a potential of a slowing economy on the horizon, what would you say?
Well, I definitely think that we ought to be looking at how the state can preserve employment, keep people working during a recession, and that would include, of course, people who work for the state or counties, but also how they can encourage the private sector to be part of this conversation and preserve jobs and be more flexible about how we keep people employed. So that would be one thing that the state can definitely do.
Beth Giesting, thanks so much for coming in. She's Executive Director of the Hawaii Budget and Policy Center. Thanks for spending time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Foodland's Give Aloha program makes it easy to donate to your favorite charity, and it matches your gift. Shop at any Foodland, Sack and Save, and Foodland Farm stores this month, and designate Hawaii Public Radio at checkout. Your donation helps to sustain our statewide public service, and along with your groceries, you'll take home our big mahalo.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we're asking you to name a prominent national sportscaster whose career took off right here in the Aloha State. Our mystery broadcaster got his start in TV as a producer for The Dating Game. Remember that one? In 1967, he was hired as a color commentator for the Los Angeles Lakers, only to be fired by broadcasting legend Chick Hearn after only four games. His announcing career was put on hold briefly until he caught on across the Pacific. In 1968, he began calling games for the Hawaii Islanders, at the time the Pacific Coast League affiliate of the Chicago White Sox. Soon after, he began calling games for UH's football and basketball teams, as well as for the state's many high school football teams. In 1969, he was named Hawaii Sportscaster of the Year. His career in the islands was relatively brief but formative. He landed a job as the lead broadcaster for the Cincinnati Reds in 1971, moving to the San Francisco Giants color commentary team in 1974. 3 years later, he was on ABC as a backup announcer, and within a few years, he'd become one of the most recognizable voices in sports. Now for today's backyard quiz, what's his name? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Next time on The World, controversy swirls around the candidacy of Benjamin Netanyahu, charges of corruption, of overreaching, of pandering to the right. So why would an Israeli want to vote for him?
I think that Bibi is the most qualified from all of them. If you choose, you want the country to be okay, I think it's Bibi.
The enduring appeal of Bibi Netanyahu on The World.
Starting this afternoon at 1.
The number of Americans struggling with hunger has declined to its lowest level since 2007. That's according to an annual report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. On a local level, Hawaii residents reported the second lowest rate in the country of what the government calls food insecurity. And that's a slightly bureaucratic-sounding term that basically means not having consistent access to a reliable and affordable supply of food. But despite what on paper looks like positive news for Hawaii, the full story is a little bit more complicated. And HBR's Ryan Finnerty is here with some explanation about that.
Hey, Bill. And yeah, as you mentioned, so the USDA collects, the U.S. Department of Agriculture collects data on food security every year. They've been doing it since 1995. And their metric for food security is that a household that has dependable access to enough food for both an active and healthy lifestyle is considered to be food secure. Mm. And the agency measures food security by using survey questions that get sent out to residents in every state. And they cover concerns over both the quantity and quality of food that a household can afford. So it's not just caloric intake, but it's also the nutritional value. And in this latest survey that was just released, it was just over 11% of U.S. households were considered to be food insecure, meaning that there were concerns within that household about being able to afford enough food at least some point during the calendar year. And that 11% rate is the lowest it's been since 2007 at a national level. And in 2008, when the Great Recession began, we had a decline in economic growth, a big increase in unemployment, and that caused food insecurity to rise. And it hit a high mark of almost 15% of all households in the United States were food insecure for at least some point during the year. So that doesn't mean the entire year they were, but at least some point. And homes with children in the household fared even worse. They hit more than 20% of homes with children reported being food insecure at the height of the recession. And to get a little bit more context and insight on what all that means, I spoke with USDA analyst Alicia Coleman Jensen. She prepared this year's report, and she told me that the correlation with the recession makes sense because the agency views low income as the most significant cause of food insecurity.
Food insecurity is closely related to economic resources. We know that poverty and low income is a significant factor for food insecurity, and we see significant variation by income level and food insecurity status. So, for example, in 2018, overall for the U.S. population, 11.1% of households were food insecure. But when you look at households with incomes below the federal poverty level, 35.3% of those households were food insecure. So there's significant variation based on income, and we see much higher food insecurity rates for low-income households.
And Bill, there were a few notable things in this report. As we mentioned earlier, one was that the national rate has finally returned to pre-recession levels. But locally, there were some interesting tidbits as well. Hawaii actually stands out as one of the states with the lowest levels of food insecurity, according to this this report and the USDA statistics. For 2018, Hawaii was assessed as having 8% of households being food insecure. That works out to around 115,000 people. For 2008, which is the most recent data that we have, only New Hampshire had a lower rate than Hawaii, which was 7.8, so not even that much lower. And New Mexico had the highest at 17%, so almost double or more than double. And in 2017, Hawaii was actually the lowest in the country. So this, according to these statistics, Hawaii is doing a pretty good job of addressing this issue of hunger. But that may not tell the whole story. And it's kind of that might seem a little weird to everybody listening because we know that Hawaii has some of the highest cost of living in the country. Mm. Grocery prices are higher than most other places in the nation. So it might seem a little counterintuitive that food insecurity would be low. And that's what Ron Mizutani, who's the CEO of the Food Bank of Hawaii, told me. And he thinks that the USDA's 8% figure is not the full picture.
I don't think that's accurate. We continue to see tremendous amount of food that goes out the door every day, roughly about 1 million pounds of food every single month, and those numbers have not declined.
And Ron told me, Bill, that he believes, and his organization believes, in conjunction with their partners in distributing food bank food, that it could be as many as 1 in 8 Hawaii residents who are struggling with hunger. That's roughly 60% more than the federal government's estimate. It would work out to around 20,000 more households than what were assessed by the federal government to be food insecure in Hawaii. And the federal data is based on survey questionnaires, which are generally regarded as a less reliable means of gathering data than some more empirical methods because people might not answer accurately. You never know who's going to respond to your survey. And so Ron said that he thinks the USDA survey questions are not capturing the full reality of many Hawaii residents' living situations.
We like to keep to ourselves as a community. We like to try to do things within our own families. That's real. We take care of our kupuna in our own homes. Because of the cost of living, there are different family structures that have multiple families in one dwelling. All of those things, to me, are also culturally driven. But also the fact that shaming is an issue with food and hunger, that's real, whether it be a child or an adult. If you were to ask 10 people on the street if they're hungry, chances are a lot of them would say no. Very few people will raise their hand to say that they're food insecure.
And so, Bill, regardless of which of the two numbers is more accurate, the federal statistics or what local authorities are saying, hunger has remained a stubborn problem across the United States since the USDA began tracking it in 1995. Even during periods of strong economic growth, the national rate of food insecurity has never really fallen below about 10% of households nationwide.
You know, it's interesting. It brings up also an issue that for a lot of government policies facing this, that how do you measure something that is difficult to get a handle on? Because as Ron said, if you responding to a survey is one thing, but then for the folks working in the trenches, knowing how much food goes out on a regular basis, that's a different story.
Yeah, I mean, and you can only work with the data that you have.
But you also need some data to work with to form policy.
Right. And you know, everyone I spoke to said the USDA information is really important, and any kind of survey like this is not going to be perfectly accurate, but it does give us at least a trend and some historical perspective to look at. I think maybe the more important thing to take away from it is that even if the federal statistics aren't capturing the whole picture, they do show us that we've never really gotten below 10% of every household in the United States being food insecure. And so that indicates that even if we were on a declining trajectory, it's still a pretty significant problem.
And that, again, that may or may not surprise some folks, both on the national figures and on the local figures. And it's I know that they don't break it down on the federal level in terms of county by county, island by island, but that's another area that would be interesting for the state to look at, certainly.
Yeah, and as we heard from the USDA analyst, Alicia Coleman Jensen, they do break it down along some social lines, like households with children, and along economic brackets, and you see that there is a pretty strong correlation between income level and food insecurity, that low-income households have much higher rates than the national average. And so for targeting policy, those are we can still gain a lot of insight from the trends being depicted in the federal data, even if the overarching umbrella number may not be totally accurate.
But as you pointed out in your piece as well, that for Hawaii, that can be a deceptive figure in terms of a national comparison, because a lot of, if you look at income levels in Hawaii, somebody living in an area, as you pointed out, with a lower cost of living might say, oh, look at that high income level. But when you take into account the cost of living, it's quite a different scenario in terms of reality.
Yeah, and I think one of the most interesting insights I gleaned from reading through this report was that almost 50% of households that are assessed as food insecure by the federal government don't actually enroll in a nutrition assistance program like food stamps, which is officially known as SNAP, or free school lunch. And the representative I spoke with at the USDA said it could be that they're just not reporting it because it is voluntary, but it could also be, and it's probably more likely, that most of those households that aren't enrolled may not be eligible for it, because the eligibility requirements are primarily based around income and dependents.
There you go.
And if you have high medical bills or you're taking care of an elderly member of the family,
it's
that's going
accounted.
To reduce your effective income.
Sure. All right. Thanks. Ryan Finnerty covers government here at Hawaii Public Radio. You can find his stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks, Ryan.
Sure thing, Bill.
national reports are as important on so many levels as the census. It impacts millions of dollars in federal funding, and the state and many local organizations want to make sure that people in Hawaii are counted. That's a story Anita Hofschneider has online at Honolulu Civil Beat, and she joins us today with today's reality check. And Anita, just to start, why is the census so critically important for Hawaii?
Well, a lot of people don't realize that the census is such an important data set that is the basis for a lot of federal funding programs. So, for example, when it comes to health care, Medicaid, a lot of times the federal government is looking at the census to figure out, you know, how much money should be flowing to Hawaii. Or even affordable housing programs, such as the low-income housing tax credit. That's often based on population, and so they'll look at the census. And so historically, unfortunately, Hawaii has been undercounted. Our response rate, you know, last time in the 2010 census was below the national average, especially on the neighbor islands. The response rates are really low. And so historically, we haven't been getting as much federal funding as we actually are entitled to.
And that difference, that was an eye-popping figure from your piece of someone that you spoke to that said that each person who is undercounted is $2,600 less per year in federal funding that Hawaii receives.
That's right. And so this is, you know, something that affects everything from school lunch programs to, like I said, affordable housing programs, medical programs. It's also something that nonprofits really rely upon. So if you think about it, when a nonprofit is applying for foundation funding, they're going to talk about, you know, X number of people in our community are here and X percent are in poverty, or we're serving, you know, this percent of people. They rely on census data for all of that. And so this is something that affects people in probably way more ways than they actually realize.
And in particular, as you point out in your piece today, that's especially true for the Native Hawaiian community here.
Yes, and this is something, you know, getting the word out about the 2020 census is something that's a priority for a lot of big Native Hawaiian organizations. So I spoke with the head of the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement, which is a nonprofit organization that works to advocate on behalf of Native Hawaiians, and they are making a huge investment in making sure that the Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander communities are responding to the 2020 census. They actually plan to spend $800,000 on this effort. They actually hired a dedicated staff member to work on this, and they're planning to do everything from creating an advertisement featuring Marcus Mariota to creating a music video featuring some famous local musicians, and to try to encourage people and get the word out about the importance of the census.
That really makes sense in terms of the financial, what's at stake financially for the state and for residents here. You know, so much of reporting about Hawaii compared to a national basis is looking at some of those differences that come screaming across from time to time. And mm-hmm. the census certainly is one of these. And again, back in your piece, one of the things that you cite is that compared to a national basis, 23% of residents of Hawaii report multiple races. And nationally, that figure is about 3%. And that is, again, just one of the ways in which Hawaii's population is different.
Yes, Hawaii's population is, you know, very different from the mainland, but also it's also difficult to count. So a high percentage of homelessness is a barrier when it comes to getting an accurate census count, because how can you count people if they are sleeping, you know, under bridges, or, you know, sleeping and they don't have a particular house and a door that you can knock on? It just makes it that much harder. Another thing that's a challenge is, you know, instead of big apartment buildings, it's often common to have families living in large houses, so, you know, monster houses, or just houses where they're broken up into different rental units, or houses with accessory dwelling units or ohana units, or even houses filled with multiple generations. And so when you think about, you know, a census worker trying to go door to door and make sure that everyone's filling out the census, it's just more challenging than if you were going door to door in an apartment building. And so there are a lot of aspects to Hawaii's population, the way that housing works here, that are barriers. Another one is the difficulty of reaching people who have English as a second language, or they don't speak English, because we have such a large immigrant community with such a great variety of languages. That's definitely a challenge. And so one thing that's that census workers are considering or the planning to do is seeing when if they can partner with community organizations. So, for example, for the Marshallese community, seeing if they can have someone who speaks Marshallese with them when they're doing that kind of outreach. But as you can imagine, this is an undertaking, a very difficult one.
A lot of threads to this story, and you can find them all in Anita's story. Anita Hofschneider with today's Reality Check. Thanks, Anita.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find her story on Hawaii in the Census at civilbeat.org. Hey, did you drive to work today? If you did, how long was your commute? And there's a reason I ask. There's something in the answer that, believe it or not, links back to ancient Rome and goes forward to prospects for urban development, including here in Hawaii. Now, that is a pretty expansive claim, but our contributing editor, Neil Milner, is here with some information to back that up in today's edition of The Long View.
Well, it's not my claim, of course. It's someone much smarter than I am. It's called the Marchetti constant, and it's named after the guy who discovered it, a physicist called Cesare Marchetti. And he shows that throughout the history of cities, so we're going back at least to the Roman Empire, people have been willing to travel as far as 30 minutes one way each day to get to work. 30 minutes, that's the threshold, one way. And he says if you and they show it, and there's an article in City Lab that illustrates this. He showed that cities expand only to the extent that 30-mile threshold is there. So for long periods of time, cities are very small, 1 mile square, and then cities begin to spread. But it still holds today. The average commute in the United States. This is average. Lots of people have more, some have less, is 26 minutes. Hawaii's average commute is a little higher, 29 minutes. So you can it's just, he calls it an anthropological invariant in travel. That's really bold. But it seems to be a thing that helps understand the kind of commute thing. And so you can sort of look at the physical history of cities in terms of how they begin to feel pressure because they're so small and they get so dense, and how technology allows cities, for better or for worse, to be able to spread out, but always with this kind of invariant there of a 30-minute threshold. People are willing to travel by whatever means necessary, 30 minutes one way to get to work, but not really more than that.
You know, but of course, the outlying aspect of this, if I can hear folks screaming over the airwaves from the west side.
Yes,
saying,
it's called the west
minutes.
Side. Yeah. Well, no, that's right. Again, we're talking averages here, and there certainly are differences. 3% of the people in this country, 3% of these people in this country travel even a longer time one way than it takes to get from Waianae to downtown in the rush hour. 90 minutes. 3% of the people in the United States travel 90 minutes one way to get to work. It appears that it's a little less than that to get from the west side into downtown. So, but we're still, it's amazing how the average holds over time and how people try to deal and why there are these outliers.
And also in terms of, I guess, urban design,
yes.
But thinking ahead to urban planning. This also plays into that whole line of thinking.
Well, that's right. And there's a lot of interesting stuff about what happens when you have different modes of transportation. The bicycle, the horse. Horse turns out not to be very good. One, because horse-drawn trolleys are slow, but also because they produce an enormous amount of manure. But what begins to change is the streetcar. Streetcars really make a big difference. And then, of course, the expressway. So if you think about where Hawaii is now in this term, you have to go, the best thing to do is to go back to the 1950s when we began to disperse a great deal because we had ways, we had the car, which becomes something that every person virtually can buy, and so you began to watch the cities disperse. You began to get suburbs. The federal government essentially encouraged this after the war by pushing people to the suburbs. You could get financed if you moved out. Hmm. You could not get financed if you wanted to stay in the inner city. So what begins to happen is they move out, and then of course we start running into problems because even the expressway, there's a limit to that kind of technology. Mm-hmm. You begin to create congestion. So you really had in the 1950s two different views about how you deal with the city, both manifested by very famous architects. One is called densification, and that's Le Corbusier was associated with that. He said, we've got to make the cities more livable and more dense at the same time.
You build
up with green spaces in between. Turns out that was in many ways a colossal failure, especially for public housing, because green spaces turned into no man's land that turned into free fire zones that nobody took ownership of. And so you had a lot of difficulty. That space turned out not to be very useful. Then there was Frank Lloyd Wright, who said the cities aren't really all that necessary anymore. The cars make it possible for people to disperse. So let's figure out a way to disperse things. And I think that Hawaii, you can see right now in what's seen as models for ways of living in the future in, let's say, in Honolulu. It's a little different than the other islands. You can see each of those being manifested in a different place. That's not surprising, but it is kind of interesting to see it. And they all have to do with having to deal with what would be called the constant, or how the technologies begin to change. So you certainly have dispersal. Mm-hmm. Kakaako is a shining example of the way you deal with moving by dispersal. And of course, rail is, you know, no rail jokes here, but rail is supposed to be the technology that would make the commute, I suppose, closer to the 30-minute commute. Mm. And that's a model. And Kapolei is a very interesting area, but it's still very much constructed like a 1950s suburb with these kind of links, freeways and so on. And then you have densification, which you see certainly in Kakaako, where you're trying to build high density with all kinds of amenities, and also with the attempt to build more dense houses that have units attached to it, increasing some of the density in other areas, and even what gets labeled as monster houses. So you have the two movements going at the same time because you basically have to, because there's no way of having just one.
Well, and in terms of expanding infrastructure, it's not like the highway system here in Hawaii has room or inducement to grow.
No, that's right. The highway system is essentially, it's done as far as facilitating dispersal. What you see is they figure out another way to add a lane on the H1 somewhere else in Pearl City, but there certainly is no way. We've really reached the kind of technological limits in terms of standard expressways. You can probably tinker around with them. I'm not a traffic engineer, but there are ways of doing it. Essentially, we're at a stage where most other cities in the U.S., if not the world, are, which is that economically and politically, it's very hard to increase the expressway system. You grew up you lived in New York City for a while. Robert Moses basically ran that city. He was a transportation czar, and he essentially built a city that was connected by freeways. You can't get one freeway through anymore. I mean, imagine trying to build another freeway in this place.
Well, and Robert Moses, of course, famously did that at a cost of chopping up neighborhoods.
Oh, yeah. He did all kinds of bad stuff. He also had pretty much his own independent taxing power.
Yes.
So our visions have changed on how we want to do it. And what you have going for you then is essentially dispersal in one place, trying to figure out a technology that would reduce that. And that, of course, is supposed to be rail, and it's not that all that clear how much congestion that's going to relieve. And then you have the densification of Kakaako as another model.
And you also have a model, actually, that in terms of neighbor islands in particular, but also here on Oahu, if you don't have to commute into a place, if you can work from home or work for a decentralized organization, that's another possibility.
Well, no, telecommuting certainly does reduce some of this. And, of course, Kapolei used to talk about being a place where you could work and live. It's got a long way to go in that regard.
Hope springs eternal.
Yes.
Political analyst, social scientist Neil Milner, contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. Thanks, Neil.
You're welcome.
Aloha, I'm Eric Soberger from Hawaii International Music Festival. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name a famous national sportscaster who sank his early career roots right here in Hawaii. After being fired from the Los Angeles Lakers color commentary staff, he moved to Hawaii and began announcing for the Hawaii Islanders as well as for UH's football and basketball games. His work earned him the Hawaii Sportscaster of the Year Award in 1969. He even appeared in an episode of Hawaii 5-0. After his time in Hawaii, he moved back to the mainland, covering baseball, football, basketball at the collegiate and professional levels, and he would go on to launch a colorful career at ABC, becoming one of the nation's best-known broadcasters, adding his voice to some of the most memorable moments in sports history. His call of the closing moments of the 1980 Winter Olympics hockey final between the United States and Soviet Union became known as the Miracle on Ice, and he was the one who told viewers of Game 3 of the 1989 World Series that a powerful earthquake had just taken place. You know that voice, and many of you did and called in. Belongs to Al Michaels, the long-running anchor of Monday Night Football who launched his career right here in Hawaii. Many callers, many of you knew that. The first to call in from Kula, Kathy McCorriston. She remembers hearing him, as did a lot of folks who called in this morning. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, it's been a year of change for the arts community here in Hawaii, and it's not even the middle of September yet. More could be on the way. Our arts and culture reporter, Noe Tanigawa, is here with more about that.
I know. There's been so much happening. Well, everybody's kind of tuned into what's up at the Honolulu Museum of Art right now. You know, they've got a director's search happening. They're finishing up the final interviews this week.
Wow.
And so they're pretty much on target, plan to hire a new director before the end of this year. Now, you know also that they're trying to sell Spalding House. They're still on track to close that before the end of the year, but they haven't chosen a realtor yet. The first of three kind of Aloha Spalding House events is coming up tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And they'll be continuing through October, November. The new chief curator is a search that's going to be really important to us, you know, arts lovers in town. That will not happen until the new director's in place. And I didn't get word on the status of a curator for the arts of Hawaii, which He Aloha Johnson has just left that post. And I don't know what's going to be happening with that yet.
Mm-hmm. A lot of movement that is, you termed it the arts infrastructure, really, here in Hawaii. And that's an interesting way to look at them.
It is. And the change is not just at the top, Bill. There are 16 staff openings right now at the Honolulu Museum.
Wow.
And we're talking really choice jobs, you would think. Events manager, corporate relations manager, public programs coordinator, youth programs coordinator. I mean, there's a lot of stuff there. And these are jobs in the arts we're talking about. Well, there have been a few available in Honolulu, and they've been filled, too. We've got a new director just in to do the three UH Manoa art galleries. Mm. This is Micah Pollux, just moved here from Brooklyn, where she had a gallery up until last year. She'll be shepherding those galleries up at UH Manoa. KCC's Koa Gallery has a new director coming up. His name is Drew Broderick. I've got a lot of hopes there. And Peggy Hopper, as you know, closed her signature gallery there in Chinatown. We talked with her.
A real shift, I mean, for all of this to be going on in a short period of time. It's really, I mean, end of an era, passing of an era seems to be an overused phrase in a lot of places, but
in Peggy's case, it really is that. So, but you know, with Mark's Garage, now that's right across Peggy Hopper's gallery, right on the corner there of Pauahi and Nu'uanu, and it has been a hub, you know, since it opened in 2001. Things are shifting there too. And I've just spoken with Donna Blanchard, who's the advisor to the Arts at Mark's board, and a new board member there, art photographer Kim Taylor Reese, who said he stepped up because this is a crucial moment there at the Arts at Mark's.
We're kind of an emergency. I mean, we don't know if we'll last 6 months or 9 months down the road if we don't.
If we don't get the support.
Are you sure?
Months away.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? What could happen?
We'd just have to shut down and be an empty building.
Well, you never mentioned that before.
We're looking at it very realistically to say we can't continue to this hand-to-mouth thing.
That's Reese and Blanchard kind of having an intervention for us here.
Boy, but that's quite something to just put that out that because, again, as you have pointed out, over time, They've had financial issues and challenges, certainly.
Well, they have, and they were left with an $82,000 debt a little over a year and a half ago. They've whittled that down to just over $25,000. So being able to do that in a year and a half's time is amazing for a small arts organization like that. But they're looking ahead and thinking, hey, we've been scrambling and, you know, what's the purpose, really, of keeping this up? They're really doing some soul-searching, and they're inviting us to join in on that. They serve about 45,000 people a year. They've got so many things going on, and maybe it's the diverse organizations, everything from UH Scientists to the Watercolor Society to Maoli Arts, all found a home there. And maybe, really, they've got to take a look at the diversity of offerings and the diverse audiences, I've got to say, we need to take some responsibility for a space that can be this inclusive. Melissa White, she's an urban planner, Bill. She works in Chinatown, and she's the new board chair for the Arts at Mark's.
Chinatown is one of the places that will always be really authentic. If nothing else, it's going to be authentic because it's not like other areas of town that are owned by a large landowner and that can be redeveloped on a wholesale basis. There's a patchwork of landowners. There's a lot of cultural uses and influences and multiculturalism, which is what makes it really cool. And, you know, the grit of Chinatown is part of its identity, and I think it always will be. But that is not uncharacteristic of artistic neighborhoods everywhere, and it's part of what helps them keep them affordable. The safety thing is something that needs to be addressed, the perception that people are not feeling safe. That's not something that can't be overcome, as we've seen from the success of First Fridays. Frankly, you know, I see a lot of potential in the transformation that's happening. You know, the ASB headquarters was built.
Oh, what's talking about? American Savings Bank's move there to across Ala Park. You know, there's 600 people in that building every day, and they have not put in a cafeteria. They have deliberately encouraged people to fan out in the neighborhood, and Really, that kind of activity is what Chinatown needs. You live right in downtown, Bill.
Yeah, exactly. And I've heard for many years, certainly a decade or more now, about the transition, transformation, and it moves in fits and starts. And it's from area to area, even within a few blocks, there's quite the differences. And you've done a lot of reporting on this as well. But really, that idea of the arts community being at the heart of that can be a powerful agent of transformation.
It can be, and this is another moment, Bill, where we're saying let's do a little visioning here, okay? Think about downtown Honolulu. Think about Honolulu Harbor. The Peace Boat is there right now. It just happens. We still have cruise ships coming in there. There's HPU, a university campus that spreads all the way down to Aloha Tower. Satellite City Hall just opened there at Chinatown Gateway Plaza, there at the corner of Hotel and Nu'uanu. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to bring a lot of people out from underneath Fort Street Mall, you know, up to, Chinatown. There's going to be a rail station at Kekalike Mall. The whole point is activity is what we need. So the Friends of the Arts at Marx say, why not join their 1,000 Friends group at $10 a month? You can get a digital portrait by Kim Taylor Reese for that now. They've got an Arts Aid concert series kicking off this Sunday, 7 p.m. fundraiser featuring Barry Flanagan of Hapa and Eric Gillian from Maui. And Melissa White is holding a community talk story about the future of arts in Chinatown September 27th at the Arts at Marx.
Good to get a little vision of that, too, in terms of how that goes from here at what is truly a time of transition within the arts community and within the infrastructure.
Exactly. And Arts at Marx is a hub. So is the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts. And tomorrow's story will be about some changes going on there.
Thanks, Noe. Noe Tanigawa, she covers, as you know, arts and culture here at Hawaii Public Radio. And as I bet you know as well, you can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. That is the program for today. Up tomorrow, vaping in Hawaii. The first case of lung damage has turned up on the Big Island. You can tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us a comment. Number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. On Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of the program or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Look under HPR News and Talk for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us tomorrow. Catherine's back for more of the Conversation.